Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, November 29, 2018. There are new indications the ceasefire is holding. And a new report says weapons made their way into South Sudan. We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The ceasefire and transitional security arrangement monitoring mechanism, also known as CITISAM, the body tasked with monitoring South Sudan's permanent ceasefire, says there has been a significant improvement in the way the warring parties are observing the ceasefire. A communication officer with CITISAM says over the past 2 weeks, there has been no fighting. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Khartoum.
Speaking at the end of a two-day technical meeting organized by CITISAM, Strategic Communications Officer Ruth Finney says out of 5 meetings CITISAMs arranged between the former warring parties since the signing of the River Talais peace agreement, this one was the only one in which no ceasefire violations were reported. Finney says a series of face-to-face meetings between government and opposition commanders in many locations across South Sudan have helped silence the guns.
We would commend the actions of the parties, you know, that they are respecting the ceasefire in the majority of the country. But we also want them to focus on the areas where the peace is in jeopardy and for these areas to not be left behind. That if we're going to implement the ceasefire, we implement it everywhere across the country.
Finney says parties to the agreement should continue to respect the ceasefire and adhere to implementation process such as evacuating schools, health centers, and worship places when ordered by the authorities to do so. Major General Martin Apucha, the SPLA-IO representative at the meeting, says SPLA-IO leaders ordered field commanders to observe the ceasefire.
Overall, significant reduction in the conflict and escalation of war. There has been no report of blocking of access to humanitarian access. This is very, very critical to allow humanitarian flow to all the areas. Even verification of forces, which was also being denied many times, now is no longer being denied.
South Sudan's opposition alliance representative, Major General David Nyangkwath, says he is confident the River Talais peace deal will hold and be implemented.
As someone who is part of the technical committee and monitoring verification mechanism, actually playing the biggest role of overseeing this this peace, I see most of the indicators are positive and indicating that peace would hold.
Finney says CITISAM will meet with field commanders of the former warring parties in the former Unity State capital Bantu early next month to ensure that the two sides build trust and confidence with one another.
We're going to engage the local commanders on the ground, the local authorities on the ground. We're going to ask questions about the implementation of the ceasefire. If they're having challenges, we want to hear about them. We want to know how the ceasefire can be facilitated in any given area.
Finney says CITISAM also wants the parties to hold accountable anyone violating the ceasefire. She also calls upon the parties to continue cooperating. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
A new report by the London-based Conflict Armament Research accuses Uganda of diverting European-made weapons into South Sudan, which the group says has helped to fuel the 5-year conflict. A military spokesman says the government acquired the weapons to protect the government against rebels. Dimo Silva Aurelio has the story for VOA from Juba.
The 101-page report says a network of U.S. and Ugandan companies controlled by British, Israeli, Ugandan and American nationals procured a military jet from the United States and an Australian-made surveillance aircraft. The aircraft entered into SPLA service during 2015 and 2016, according to the report. Since 2014, the report says at least 2 of SOA companies registered in Seychelles acted as brokers or intermediaries in actual or attempted arms supplies to South Sudan. A third Seychelles company brokered the export of ammunition from Romania via the Slovak Republic of Uganda in 2015, according to Conflict Armament Research Report. It documents hundreds of weapons and more than 200,000 rounds of ammunition used in the conflict. Ugandan government spokesman Ofondo Opondo did not respond to repeated calls or a text message requesting an interview from South Sudan in Focus. On July 13th, the UN Security Council slapped an arms embargo on South Sudan, but military supplies outlined in this report entered South Sudan much earlier. The findings suggest that neither the original supplier companies nor the US or Australian governments were aware that their aircraft were being used in the retransfer of weapons to the South Sudan government. The report says the retransfers from Uganda to South Sudan may have breached end use or non-transfer commitments made to exporters as a prior condition of sale. South Sudan's military spokesman, Major General Lul Roy Kwong, says South Sudan acquired such armament in order to protect the government against the SPLA-IO.
We did what was required of us to restock, to resupply, and defend the territorial integrity of the country and defend the democratic government from being toppled using illegal means. These equipment were purchased, whether they came through Uganda or they did not come through Uganda. We had a legitimate cause. We had a good reason. At the time, the National Army was fighting a rebellion.
The report says Israel, Ukraine, and United Arab Emirates and China had stopped supplying ammunition to South Sudan since 2013. But Kwong says South Sudan is a sovereign country and has the rights to enter into contractual deals with any country it wishes for its supply of weapons now that the warring parties have signed a peace deal.
All the countries you had referred to stopped dealing with us. Maybe they did so because they were complying with the international requirements that you should not continue dealing with the South Sudan army because they are at war. But now that the peace agreement has been signed, the same partners would be dictated by the reality that this country has signed peace agreement.
The report also documented secret shipments of Sudanese and Chinese manufactured weapons from Sudan to opposition fighters in South Sudan by air and land from 2014 until at least mid-2015. SPLA-IO Deputy Military Spokesman Colonel Lampol Gabriel says the SPLA-IO does not receive military supplies from foreign contractors.
We do not have any sort of supply of ammunition or guns apart from getting it from the government. We get from the government. We buy even from them. You know, we have our people inside those towns. They give us.
Gabriel does not rule out the fact that such cartridges were found, but says there are multiple armed groups at the border of Sudan with South Sudan.
We have the Sudan Liberation, the SLM. They fight alongside the border there. And Sudan government have been coming following these people close to the border. So in case there is some exchange of things here and there, they were maybe brought by the militia because the militia have been fighting alongside the government of South Sudan to fight us. So it doesn't mean finding a crate of ammunition in our stockpile. Has not been that we imported, no.
It took 4 years for Conflict Armament Research to release its full report. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Harare, where the Zimbabwean Ministry of Health is urging pharmaceutical stores to accept local currency from people who do not have US dollars or other foreign currencies to purchase drugs. Gondo Kudita reports from Harare.
Ministry of Health is on record directing the pharmaceutical sector here to accept local currencies and medical aid cards for drugs. The government says it is exploring ways of making medicines and related goods available and affordable to consumers and businesses. They say it should provide relief to those who do not have access to the dollar and to the rand, including those with chronic diseases such as cancer, diabetes, and hypertension. Potiva Mwendera is a spokesperson for the Pharmaceutical Society of Zimbabwe. He maintains that the problem centers on the inadequate allocation of foreign currency by the government and on the pricing of pharmaceutical products. He explains how the pharmaceutical industry views the matter.
The sector is mainly a price taker and has been charging US dollars to ensure availability as the suppliers have been asking for payment in hard currency for their stocks. So the directive by government to charge in a more available form of payment is welcome, but the hope from the industries that we are not trading affordability for availability, meaning to say that we pray that the government has allocated adequate foreign currency for the importation needed in the sector.
The pharmaceutical industry imports medicines from countries such as India, South Africa, and Botswana. The sector owes US $29 million to suppliers who have been saddled in this instance with letters of credit. Chemists and doctors say they may not be able to sustain operations if they implement the government's directive to use local rather than foreign currency. Observers say, although there are local drug manufacturers such as Natfem, Varicam, and Detlab, they only account for 5% of the medicines that are used within the country. Even then, the raw materials for the manufacture of drugs have to be imported, and this again requires foreign currency. The financial crisis has been brewing for some time, but the confusion worsened when the incoming finance minister announced that the government planned to do away with the local currency called bond notes.
Charging in Forex started on a grand scale around the 7th of October 2018, and this was triggered by the demand of payment upfront in hard currency for supplies. Medicines are primarily imported into Zimbabwe, and with inadequate foreign currency allocations, there are disruptions in the supply chain.
Observers say, however, that the local pharmaceutical sector is guilty of charging in foreign exchange, including what they are buying in local bond notes. The finance minister and other government officials call the practice extortion. In his budget speech, the minister proposed a move that some observers claim borders on price controls.
Pharmaceutical manufacturers shall be required to publish the maximum recommended retail price agreed among manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers. Whilst this measure is intended to provide transparency in the pricing of essential drugs,
the pharmaceutical sector blames price disparities on a breakdown in the supply of medicines. The sector is having to rely on various sources to procure drugs. They also contend that the government's allocation of foreign exchange to the sector to import drugs is too little to cover costs. As the medicinal retailers refuse to speak on the record, expressing concern about what they say is the public's unjustified anger toward them for trying to keep their businesses afloat. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigono.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, lawmakers in Jonglei State have a reason to smile. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
who gives you the best advice?
My mom. She gives me the best advice because I could see that from childhood to now, whatever she had advised me to do has made me a successful person.
My best friend, most of the times. Yeah, my best friend. Because I think she's the one I'm more open to. I tell her most of my things going on in my life.
Yeah, my mom. I always miss seeing my mom because she's always closer to me. And anytime she sees anything about me, even I don't tell her, she knows. She feels emotional for me, and I think she's the best person who can give me an advice.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Civil servants and residents in the Jonglei State capital, Bor, are criticizing the state government for increasing the salaries of lawmakers and top state officials, including ministers. The State Council of Ministers passed resolutions nearly tripling their salaries in April. As we hear from Jacob Achek in Bor, the salary increment is now being implemented.
The Jonglei Council of Ministers resolution hiking the salaries of top officials from the governor on down to county commissioners was passed on April 5. According to the resolution signed by Jonglei State Secretary General Benjamin Lamater, the monthly salary of a MP with no other position in the state assembly has been increased from 10,450 Sudanese pound, or $45, to 63,500 SSP, the equivalent of about $265. Civil servants and residents have criticized the decision. Bo resident Chol Kwan says citizens elected politicians to work for the interests of general public, not to enrich themselves.
The civil servants are now about 6 months without getting their salary, but the member of parliament, which are elected by the people, are now increasing their salary. That law is not correct. It's not favor the civil population in South Sudan.
Speaking in Arabic, resident Philip Makera Anek is calling on the state legislature an executive to help the people, not themselves.
You were taken to the parliament to monitor activities such as hunger, diseases, and other services that affect human lives. Now, if you have money, you increase salaries of workforce so that they enjoy like you too. The life is difficult. For me now, I'm South Sudanese employee. I'm paid 700 South Sudanese pounds. And that 700 South Sudanese pound is for one plate of one feeding and not for the whole month.
A state civil servant Manyang Duanjok, who works in the Ministry of Cabinet Affairs, finds it incredible that lawmakers boosted their own salaries and those of other top officials, while state employees have not been paid in 6 months.
When money is not there and you keep raising your salaries to the high level, where should you get money? For me, I think it is not meeting the reality, because they are public representatives, they are politicians, and technocrats are supposed to be the one receiving funds before politicians.
Jonglei State Finance Minister James Yana Lier says increasing the salaries of constitutional post holders and parliamentarians is legal and was approved last year.
The assembly was the first to complain, and then the other post holders was them. So when we did the 16-17 budget, we raised them. After we raised the trade union, we raised them. Only that it was not a raising, but we gave them those services that were used to be collected at the ministries to get them here.
Garangbul Maleng, Director General in the Ministry of Finance and Economic Planning, says the government is trying to implement a 50% rise in the salaries of civil servants.
The emoluments of the constitution force holders is the responsibility of the Council of Ministers, and it was discussed and passed. Also, the legislation was also passed to be implemented. So the little resources we have implemented last month. We will not bring any chaos, because it is the same government which is planning also for the workforce.
Paul Bola Yom, who chairs the Committee for Information in the State Legislative Assembly, says before the South Sudanese pound lost value, they used to receive a salary of 7,000 South Sudanese pounds, or about $3,000 a month in 2010. Ayom defends the increase in salaries of lawmakers and constitutional post holders because the local currency has lost much of its value.
I cannot say that it is a real increase, because I, as a chairperson in the assembly, before that increase, so-called increase, has happened, my salary was unable to buy $50. So if there is an increase which has happened now, it may buy more or less like $100. So for MP or constitutional post holder, to have a salary of $100 is nothing.
Ayom or other lawmakers did not say when civil servants would receive their back pay or when their salaries would be increased for the same reason. For VOA News, I'm Jacob Achek in Bor.
A lot of questions arose about the role of the dowry system during the case of a South Sudanese girl named Nyalong. Some have blamed the dowry system for furthering the practice of marrying off girls. Jok Madur Jok, an anthropologist, says the practice is a lot more complicated than some media outlets have reported.
South Sudan has a serious problem of child marriage, no question about it. We are told that upward of 60-65% of all marriages across South Sudan involve a girl who is below the age of majority of 18 years, according to South Sudan Child Act 2008. And so when this case of Nyalong came up, it wasn't really initially about her age, because really nobody knows how old she is. It was initially about a well-established Dinka tradition where people can compete with the number of cows they can pay in bride wealth for a wife. A number of media outlets picked that up and started blaming Facebook for allowing an auction to take place online. Thomson Reuters reported it, then CNN picked it up. Another word that was used that became rather offensive to South Sudanese is the idea that it was a savage practice. It was an uncivilized. The savage is the word CNN used. So a lot of people felt offended that their culture, their traditions that have been going on for since time immemorial were being described in such racist terms. And so the whole thing just caught fire. But it is really a case of misunderstanding of a simple practice where men can compete for a wife. And in a lot of cases, it is not the highest bidder who gets the girl. In addition to cows you are paying, there is always also another practice where people look into one's background first. And even questions about how you acquired those cows. If the cows were inherited, then they are much more prized than cows whose origin is unclear. Perhaps you raided them. Perhaps you are a corrupt official who has stolen and bought the cows. People go into the background, your character, such that even a man who has paid the least number of cows sometimes can walk away with a bride.
Well, I've spoken to a few South Sudanese who say that the dowry reduces women to just property, even to a commodity. What's your take on that? What role does the dowry play in the way that women are portrayed in South Sudan?
Well, increasingly, say over the last three decades, bride wealth, as it is appropriately called, has changed from the times when it used to be more symbolic, such that people were using it as a way to cement the relationship between the two families now being joined by marriage. It was meant to be a symbolic glue between the two families. And the Dinka say that we are related because we eat together. So if two families come together and they exchange food, in this case cows, then the relationship is made stronger. And the relationship is not just between the wife and the husband. The relationship now is between two families with all their extended lines. And so in the past, it used to be just a symbolic thing. You paid however many cows you think your wife-to-be is worth to you, not in material terms. But in terms of your affection for her and affection for their family.
But Joke, if I could just interject for a second, the term that you used is that a man pays the amount that he thinks that his wife to be is worth. And I want to speak on behalf of the activists and ask, how can you determine a woman's worth, a human being's worth? I think that that's where a lot of the anger and frustration is coming from, the side of the activist.
Yeah, I also have an issue with the kind of bride wealth that is being paid these days, where people have gone overboard and become lavish as a way to demonstrate that you are capable. Whereas in the past, it was more your character that was now in question.
That's Jok Madud Jok, a South Sudanese anthropologist, speaking to my colleague Ayen Bior from London. Kakuma refugee camp is one of the largest camps in the world, hosting more than 140,000 refugees from more than 16 countries. More than half of them are South Sudanese refugees. My colleague Ayen Dengbior was at Kakuma yesterday and says while the camp is underdeveloped, it's filled with ambitious refugees who continue to hope for a better future despite challenges.
I was in Kakuma because there was a town hall there surrounding solar power in the camps. Less than 20% of people in Kakuma have access to energy, and much less have access to clean energy. And so I was there in partnership with Chatham House to host a town hall about solar energy, the challenges and the opportunities and the solutions surrounding solar energy.
During your time at Kakuma Refugee Camp, did you meet South Sudanese refugees there? And if so, what are they telling you?
Yeah, in fact, more than half of Kakuma's population are South Sudanese. And I also met with a couple of Sudanese refugees as well. I spoke with one woman in particular. She's 16 years old, and she was telling me that she desperately wants to become a nurse. And she's going to school in Kakuma, but she says she's very aware of the restrictions that she has because of her status as a refugee and her inability to come back home. But regardless, she told me that she will continue to be positive about the future and do everything that she can to get out of the refugee camp. The other thing that I realize about Kakuma is that there are people who have lived there for a very, very, very long time. There was one young man that I met. He came there when he was about 4 years old. And he's 19 years old right now, and he's lived there ever since. So really all he's ever known in his life is Kakuma Refugee Camp. This young man was particularly strong, and so I asked him, what do you do? And he told me that he does work out in Kakuma, and he plays a lot of soccer because his dream is to become a international soccer player. So despite the challenges of Kakuma, there's still a lot of dreams there. I met another young woman who saw me and she knew my name because I work for the Voice of America, and she told me that she also wanted to become a journalist. So again, just a lot of dreams in Kakuma and a lot of refugees who continue to dream despite their challenging circumstances.
I was in Nairobi for many, many years, but I've not been to Kakuma Refugee Camp, and we hear all kind of stories there that it looks like another world altogether.
You know, I was actually surprised to realize that Kakuma is one of the most diverse, if not the most diverse, refugee camp in the world. More than 16 countries are represented in Kakuma. And I met with an official in Kakuma who said that there are even a couple of Syrians in Kakuma. So just imagine that. But, you know, I mean, it's when you look at Kakuma, you really see homes that are built from anything that people can find. And so there's metal that they use for the roof. And then there's mud that some people use for the walls of the home. And there's no running water in the camp at all. It's really like any typical refugee camp. It's severely underdeveloped. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, Chatham House is doing studies there, is because they at least want to bring solar energy into the camps so that students can read at night and so that the hospitals there can run on solar energy to keep the medicines cold and see patients at night when it gets dark.
I know that you didn't get a lot of opportunity to interact with the host community there, but if you got that opportunity, how would you describe the attitudes of the host community towards refugees in Kakuma?
Every single person that I spoke to said that they wanted to go back home. That is really their attitude, is this idea that they have a longing for their homes and they want to go back to normal life. But what they told me is that they can't trust their homes. What they told me is that they are afraid to go home. Because they don't know what will happen to them if they do go back home. And so Kakuma gives them some solace. It gives them refuge. But what's really on their minds is, when will they get to go home? Because nobody wants to grow up in a refugee camp. No one wants to spend their entire life in a refugee camp. And that's what I kept hearing over and over and over again. They kept telling me that they were suffering. They kept telling me that they didn't have enough to eat. They kept telling me that, you know, their kids are getting sick because of, you know, dirty water. So there's just a lot going on in the refugee camp. And most people just really want to go back home. I mean, that's really what it boils down to.
That's my colleague Ayen Dengbior. She was speaking to me today from Nairobi. I'm John Tanza in Washington, and thank you for being our host tonight.